from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Today you're listening to a special edition of Intersection from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the University of Missouri campus. Later in the show, our live audience here will join in on today's conversation about the state of obesity in Missouri. In 2013, the adult obesity rate in Missouri was 30.4%, the 16th highest among states in the U.S. To put that in context, back in 1980, no state in the country had an obesity rate even above 15%. Now, 20 states have an obesity rate over 30%. Every state is above 20%. So what happened? Obesity rates climbed steadily across the country over the last three decades. And today we want to talk about how we got here, which we think can inform the ways the issue can be addressed now. Our panel today will help us with that. Dr. Anish Tosh works for the Adolescent Obesity Clinic, ADOBE, on clinical and research projects with the University of Missouri Health System. Dr. Tosh, welcome back to Intersection.
Thank you.
Chris Fulcher is the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental System, CARES for short. His applied research focuses on helping and implementing social innovations for strategic planning and decision support. Chris, thanks for being here. And Donna Murley is a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. She works with the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Nutrition Education, and coordinates the work of the Missouri Council for Activity and Nutrition. Donna previously worked for the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, where she focused on aging, WIC, and obesity reduction and prevention. Donna, thanks for joining us. And for you and our listening audience, this live forum was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls this week, but you can share your comments or watch the video of this week's show at kbia.org. So to start off, we're going to pick this apart as the show goes on, but we'll start with you, Donna. I mentioned in the open there some statistics about the significant climb we've seen in obesity rates, not just in Missouri, but across the country. What are some of the main reasons to you? What's one of the big things that have contributed to that climb in the recent decades?
Well, actually, we've made major changes in our lifestyle. The foods that we have available to us are multivaried, and they're in many different areas. They're more readily available. Mm-hmm. And then our physical activity has also declined. And actually, the roots of obesity probably began after World War II. There were many soldiers or men who were unable to be in the armed forces because they were physically unfit. They were coming out of the Great Depression, and they were just malnourished. And so after the war, then it was decided that this was never going to happen to us again. Well, unfortunately, we're now on the other side, and we also have men who are no longer, or candidates who are no longer eligible for military service because they're too heavy. The things that I don't know, I'm dating myself, but I grew up in a small town where the gasoline stations just had gasoline or maybe oil or things like that. And if there was one of those little pin, you know, those penny machines where you can get gum, I mean, that was uptown. And now, when you go to buy gasoline, look at the wide range of foods. And our food sources have increased in calories. The food companies, their job is to sell food. And so they make it so that we want to eat it. So there's a lot of sugar, fat, and salt in those foods. So we're eating more. Calorie-wise, we're probably eating 200 to 300 calories more a day. And in terms of physical activity, we have engineered a lot of that physical activity out of our lives. Looking at how we do cooking in the home, women used to use cast iron skillets, you know, heavy, moving the cast iron skillets. Now they're very light, we use microwaves. You know, we have a lot less food production, food preparation, because we have a lot of convenience foods. Other things, you know, we have a lot more TV time. Our kids are more into playing video games, that kind of thing. It's less physical activity. And we've done that in many different aspects. I know when I was in school, you know, we learned how to prepare foods or stay at your workstation with the least amount of movement, be as most efficient as you could in order to produce whatever you were working on at that workstation. The other thing is, when you look at doors are, you know, very light, they're much lighter, and a lot of them have that push button. Now, those push buttons are great for people who are handicapped and need that assistance, but for those of us who are able, we're missing that opportunity to use a few more calories. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to go back to that you mentioned there on that list, and the list can go on, it will, for the course of this night. But one of the things you mentioned was, I think, the accessibility of some of these, you know, less nutritious foods, you know, like at the gas station and things like that. Dr. Tosh, what do you think, how do you think that's contributed? How's that played a factor, especially in recent years?
Yeah, no, I think that's huge. And so I agree with what Donna said. I mainly teach children and adolescents. That's my focus, I'm a pediatrician. So what I see with my patients and with the kids that I see is a lot of what they're eating is from convenience stores. And you don't have to go very far. The main high schools here, even in our town of Columbia, there's quite a few convenience stores and fast food restaurants. And with the open lunch policies that a lot of our high schools have, that's what our kids are eating. I would say the single biggest issue that I see with my patient population is sugared beverages. Mm. Those are my patients who've been successful with weight loss. Cutting sugared beverages has been the key. But sugared beverages taste so good, and it's so fun, and really cheap. And so it's hard to tell a teenager that that's not something to do. That's, you know, they look at you like you have three heads.
Well, it's not just soda. It's juice. It's even Gatorade, things like that.
You're absolutely right. It's not just soda. It's everything you mentioned. And, you know, for example, you mentioned juice, and I'm glad you brought that up because I get a lot of parents who are surprised when we recommend against juice for our teenagers. But it really is not any healthier than soda. So that's a good point. So I think that's where we really focus on is with our patient population, the teenagers that I see, the sugared beverages, I would say, is the biggest issue that we deal with.
Yeah, there are some genetic factors too, though, right? Let's talk about those a little bit, I guess.
Absolutely. So, as we do more research, and I also do research in obesity, it's not just calories in and calories burnt with exercise. We know it's more than that. There's a lot more variables. And so we definitely know there's a genetic basis behind obesity that tends to run in families. Way back in the caveman days, it was a good thing that you would maintain calories because we would eat maybe only every other day. And so it was a good thing that we would hold on to our calories. But what was protecting us a long time ago now is working against us because now food is plentiful. We're not exercising as much like Donna mentioned. And so what was protective in the past is now working against us. So yes, genetics is a big thing. Unfortunately, we really can't change genetics. We're born with it, obviously, and so what we can change is the diet and exercise, like Donna mentioned.
All right. I need to take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the state of obesity in Missouri. Over the last three decades, obesity rates in the state and across the country have more than doubled, growing steadily. Today, our guests are helping us figure out how we got here, which we hope will inform our way forward. We're joined by Dr. Anish Tosh with the Adolescent Obesity Clinic on clinical and research projects with the University of Missouri Health System. Chris Fulcher is the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental Systems. And Donna Murley is a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. She coordinates the work of the Missouri Council for Activity and Nutrition. This is a special edition of Intersection from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the University of Missouri campus. This live forum was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls this week, but later in the show, our live audience will join in on today's conversation. Today's show is produced in partnership with the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk. And so another thing that you had mentioned, Donna, earlier on was, like the doors that open up for you, things like that. So, Chris, that's part of what we call the built environment, right? And so maybe talk a little about how that has also affected a lot of this these trends, I guess.
Sure. Built environment as opposed to our natural environment is really around housing. It's around green spaces in neighborhoods, parks, our road networks, et cetera. And how we actually interact and work in these built environments really informs the amount of exercise we have, the walkability of our cities, the way we can bike to work or not. So for many, many years, there have been a lot of impediments around the way that we've constructed built environments. It's not just having parks. But it's the condition of parks. Are the parks safe? Are the swings and all the equipment, are they in good condition? Is there crime? So just talking, and it's very, very complex when we talk about built environment, just even the attributes with built environment, what are the conditions? And that's really getting to more the larger population level.
And that's what your organization CARES has worked with some mapping projects, right? So how might that help address these kinds of issues?
Sure. First, mapping, really, there's a saying about a picture says it tells 1,000 words. It's actually the literal translation is 10,000 words. And really having a map really helps change the conversation because you're able to visually look at people in place. So with what we do with mapping is you can overlay, for example, your built environment. You can look at areas of poverty. You can look at education attainment. You can look at access to different types of food services. You can look at SNAP retail locations, or you can look at grocery stores, food banks, etc. So it gets very complex when you look at people and place and who has access to what services. You talk about convenience stores and where they're located. What are the underlying socioeconomic and demographic characteristics? And that's what we look at. It. Not the individual level, but more the broader population level. And mapping really helps begin the conversation of saying, well, what are the conditions that we can change in our area to improve physical activity, walkability, et cetera?
Yeah, and it's backed up by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's most recent numbers. Poverty levels and education levels definitely affect the likelihood that someone will have obesity, diabetes issues, those types of things, right? So what are some of the things, I guess, Donna, that, you know, the state especially has been looking at these issues for a long time, of course, but, you know, what are some of the dynamics that surround that conversation of how you get it to that population and try to change that trend?
Well, you can, it's multifaceted. Sure. One of the things that we do at the University of Missouri Extension is we have the SNAP Ed education component. And so we do a lot of education for the lower income people in a very large number of sites throughout the state. And so education, people cannot do what they don't know. So, you know, we teach them about reading food labels and how to cook foods that are healthier for them. The other thing that we're doing is we're working to change the environments around them. We're working with food banks and we're working with the convenience stores to have healthier choices there as well. And it's we've changed so much over the years that it's going to take us some time to make those changes.
Yeah, absolutely. What other kind of cultural issues are there involved in this conversation as well?
I think one area that we work in is looking at health equity and health disparities. And we talk about childhood obesity. It's not in a vacuum, but it's in a societal context, and the cultural conditions, the economic conditions, so there are many different ways you look at this complexity. And so from a mapping perspective, we look at the overlaps in types of services or where there are no services, and it goes beyond. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, yes, has really been focusing over the past number of years on childhood obesity, but so has the YMCA of the USA, or YUSA, CDC, many nonprofit organizations around the country are all trying to address this epidemic around childhood obesity. So being able to look at this visually and mapping of where investments are going and where we have these interventions, we can learn a lot from each other across these mapped areas.
Yeah, as you're saying, it's an issue across the country, of course. What are some of the issues specific to Missouri, I guess, right? And that population distribution we have, obviously we have a lot of rural areas, things like that. What are some of the challenges we face in Missouri as far as this issue? Because we, for many years now, have trended downward on the list of rankings, and I think I said now we're about 16th on, depending on what rankings you look at, on obesity rates. So what are the things specific to Missouri, I guess?
Rural Missouri. Many of the higher obesity rates are in rural Missouri, and part of that has to do with no place to be physically active. Also, the food choices are different. We've grown up in an agricultural area where when people went out and farmed really a lot and had a lot of chores and things like that, they would use a lot of these calories up, but now that's not necessarily true. People are concerned about their children being snatched, so they don't want their children out playing. There are a lot of food deserts where there may be only one grocery store in a county, and it's a long way away from, you know, some of the population that we have.
Sure. Anything else? I mean,
yes,
you've been talking about
rural Missouri and access to those services. And where you talk about convenience stores, and I think it's Michael Pollan that used the term food-like substances as opposed to food.
Yes.
And it's just, what would your grandparents eat as opposed to what we're eating today? And if it's not what your grandparents can recognize, then it's more likely a food-like substance. So it's really a challenge looking at that rural-urban differential in terms of access to the healthy food options, fruits and vegetables, et cetera. And you think in rural areas that there may be more, but there's actually less opportunities.
Dr. Tosh, I'm wondering, anybody else can jump in here too, but what are the challenges in trying to talk with patients about obesity and you know, realizing the situation, the gravity of the situation? What are some of the challenges in changing behavior?
Thanks. That's a great question, because that's a lot of what we deal with up front. It's hard to address the issue if the family doesn't realize it's an issue. And for a lot of family members, when it's not just the child that's overweight, it's the parent, it's everyone they see in their family, maybe in their even in their community. So it's hard to sometimes just broach the topic that this is a concern. So we spend a lot of time. I work with a great team. It really isn't just me. I have a great team of dietitians and who work with our patients. I try to identify that, you know, there is a potential risk for medical problems, that you know, that the child's weight could be a problem, and so that's sometimes hard. We know that there's different causes for obesity for various patients, and so it's not always just diet. Sometimes it's more exercise, and we know for some kids, mental health, behavioral issues can also lead to obesity. And so we get into those issues. As you can imagine, that can be very sensitive. So you have to be very sensitive. It's always hard to talk about someone's weight. You know, it can be just immediately a very uncomfortable situation. But we try to be very sensitive in our clinic and try to come at the patient's level and figure out what changes can we make, what do they understand about the problem, do they see any issue with this? Usually what I find is someone in the family's mentioned to a parent of a concern for the child, that it wasn't the physician for the first time bringing the issue up to the family members, or someone, an aunt, a grandmother, someone has had some concerns. And so we kind of play upon that concern by the family member and then just trying to say, okay, let's work on some issues here. Is there places for you to exercise? What can we do in terms of reducing your sugar beverages, for example? So we individualize the treatment. Every overweight or obese child comes from a different situation, and so we try to address that situation specifically for the patient.
Our health reporter who helped put the show together did a series on Healthy Nevada, which is this project Cerner's working on in Nevada, a town that has a lot of obesity, diabetes issues. And she said that one of their methods was that they tried to stress the economic impact on a single person that their diabetes or obesity may have. And they thought that actually ended up being effective. That's kind of a drastic and somewhat unusual measure, but is that something that you think could be effective on a personal basis?
Absolutely. You know, and getting back, I feel like I'm always talking about the sugar beverages, but we are trying to advise patients and families to drink less sugar beverages. So you would think that by having them spend less money on something, that's something that would be a good thing. And again, there's some resistance, but then we get into the cost factor. Think about how much money you would be saving if you weren't buying soda every day or every week. And so absolutely, we try to approach it from various ways from a health standpoint, but also from a financial standpoint. If that rings a bell for the family, we go for it.
Let me take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the state of obesity in Missouri. Over the last three decades, obesity rates in the state and across the country have more than doubled, growing steadily. And today our guests are helping us figure out how we got here, which we hope will inform our way forward. We're joined by Dr. Anish Tosh with the Adolescent Obesity Clinic on clinical and research projects with the University of Missouri Health System. Chris Fulcher is the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental Systems, or CARES. And Donna Murley is a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. She coordinates the work of the Missouri Council for Activity and Nutrition. This is a special edition of Intersection from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the University of Missouri campus. This live forum was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls this week, but later on in the show, our live audience will join in on today's conversation. So, Donna, you did. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you had some experience with DHSS as well. What were some of the statewide efforts to address this issue while you were there, and some of the efforts now as well, I guess?
Okay. Yes, there are lots of efforts going on. And one of the first ones was to build capacity in the state in order to bring collaboration. One of the biggest ways to make a difference is to have your partners collaborating well together and to making sure you're not duplicating or letting things fall through the cracks. And so we have the MOCAN is an organization of about 50 to 80 groups that affect Missourians' lives every day. And we have a plan, a strategic plan that's developed by that group. And each, we have 7 work groups, and each work group has a particular area that they try to implement that plan. And one of the things that we're doing is, right now, is each work group is developing an infograph about what are the issues related to theirs. Like this one is the child and child care and schools work group, and it talks about childhood obesity, you know, what kind of actions we need to take, what the stats are, what solutions are, just to help people better understand the complexity of the obesity problem in Missouri and how we can go about making changes. The one thing that I thought was very interesting about what you said in terms of, you know, the whole community may be heavy, that's one thing that we found that it's hard for people to understand about the obesity problem because such a large percentage of us are overweight or obese. And so people think that's the healthy weight. And there have been people who have lost weight and still have been overweight, but people are telling them that they look way too skinny.
A recent CDC said in Missouri report said that in Missouri, 65% of Missourians are overweight. Right, that's what you're talking about there. So, yeah, so how do you, yeah, that's, I mean, compared to, again, where we were even in 1980, that's a huge change, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you communicate that to people?
Well, you talk about the health issues. You show them information that shows when you're at this BMI, these are the kinds of health issues that you can look forward to in the future. It's going to cost you this much more in terms of health care during the year. And really, you just really work with them, and you know, on a population-wide, it's a little easier because a lot of times we're talking to the organizations, but with individual people, that person requires a lot of intensive education in order to make those connections and help them to feel better. People who have lost weight will tell you that they feel better, but you have to lose the weight first in order to feel better.
Right. And so, Donna, you also mentioned, or we've been talking a lot about children, and there have been some changes in recent years with both the WIC program and school lunches, right? And so those have possibly been some positive changes, right?
Oh, most definitely. The WIC food package has changed quite a lot, and they get fruits and vegetables, and there's reduced the amount of juice. And so that does reduce the number of calories that are going into the children receiving WIC benefits. And actually, in Missouri, the weight status for our children in that age group has stabilized, I guess. You know, it's still too high, but we're at least not climbing with that age group. In terms of school lunch, yes, those school lunches, I'm sure people who are parents have heard some complaints about those, but it does make a difference in terms of introducing healthier foods to children and teaching them, you know, what a good nutritious diet looks like.
What kind of misconceptions do you get about, you kind of talked about it there, that people don't even realize maybe that they're overweight or even obese, but what other misconceptions do you see in your work, especially you two, Donna and Dr. Tosh?
I think one of the bigger things that I see, again, when I work with children, adolescents, and their parents, is that the parent believes that the child will grow out of their obesity or their overweight status, which may be true if the child's very young, but every year the child gets older and still overweight, increase the likelihood they're going to be overweight as adults. So most kids, unfortunately, do not outgrow their overweight or obesity. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions that we hear. Another one that's interesting that I hear sometimes is that my child needs more food because they're big, as opposed to the other way around. And so it's almost as a justification. Because my child is big, he or she needs more food. And usually it's the opposite problem. They've eaten more food, and therefore they're bigger. And so, you know, but, you know, we hear these things, and that's okay. It's nice to hear where the parents are coming from. And then we try our best to work on maybe correcting some of those myths they may have.
Donna, what about you? Do you get many other misconceptions or in your work?
Yes, a lot of people feel like they can't do anything about it. You know, it's just the way it is, and my mother was this way, my grandmother was this way, and I'm going to be this way also. And that's not true. We can make changes in our health. Some of the things that I think is interesting, too, is we did, several years ago, we did some focus groups across the state with teenagers, the high school students, and it was astonishing to me the number of children who eat until they're stuffed. And so that's one of the big misconceptions is you need to eat until you're satisfied. You don't need to be walking out of a meal feeling like you're just really overly full. We try to teach people to eat according to how they feel, not with their eyes. Just because there's a portion size there doesn't mean you have to eat a larger portion. That is one of the things that's changed dramatically in our environment, is the size of portions of foods. And teaching people what a normal portion is or a healthy portion is compared to what they get at a restaurant or whatever is really eye-opening for them. And we were talking prior to this session starting about reading food labels. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that you work on a lot with your patients' parents.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, food labels have been on food for decades. However, still, we sometimes have parents who have really no idea of how many calories are in food and what percent is fat, sugar, protein. And so a lot of what our dietitians spend time with our patients and their parents is just how to read a food label, which may seem very, very basic for a lot of us. But for a lot of our families who are struggling with obesity, that's something that's unusual or foreign to them. And so we do take the time for them to teach them how to read a food label and what's healthy and what's not. That's a lot of what our dietitians work with our patients and their families on.
Getting back to that portion size, is there anything we can attribute that to? Or I guess is it just the culture change over the last few decades, or why has that happened? Do we know?
Well, part of it is food is relatively cheap in our society. We, in terms of portion of the income that we spend on food, ours is very low compared to most of the rest of the world. And so when you're trying to encourage people to come into your restaurant or buy your product, then what you do is you take the cheaper portion and you add some additional food because then you get more value for your buck. I mean, we are a very value-laden society. We want the best we can get for that buck or whatever it is that we're spending. So that's part of it. And you can look at, there's pictures on the internet about, you know, what sizes were. Like, for instance, you know, the fast food restaurants, their hamburgers. The child's hamburger now is what the hamburgers for adults were when they first opened. So, you know, it really has grown.
Hello and welcome back to Intersection, a production with the Reynolds Journalism Institute and KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuelner, and today we're talking about the state of obesity in Missouri. Over the last three decades, obesity rates in the state and across the country have more than doubled, growing steadily. Today, our guests are helping us figure out how we got here, which we hope will inform our way forward. We're joined by Dr. Anish Tosh with the Adolescent Obesity Clinic on Clinical and Research Projects with the University of Missouri Health System, Chris Fulcher, the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental Systems, or CARES, and Donna Murley, a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. She coordinates the work of the Missouri Council for Activity and Nutrition. This is a special edition of Intersections from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the University of Missouri campus. This live forum was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls this week, but later in the show, our live audience will join in on today's conversation. Today's show is produced in partnership with the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk. So during the break, Chris, I didn't give you a chance to talk about misconceptions because I didn't want to put you on the spot since you're not always working out in the field like these guys are. But you had a good example of some misconceptions you come across in your work as well.
Sure. So as we've been hearing more at the individual level, and what we're involved in more is zooming out from the individual to more the community level, the regional level, the state, and the national level, looking at patterns and looking at people in place in a broader way. Some misconceptions that we've seen is around built environment. And we've seen in recent years the real economic driver is really around walkability, having trails, and being able to meet the needs of a workforce that are looking for those kind of amenities. So really helping us change from a business community perspective, you know, what is important in a community, and we're seeing more and more of the use of trails, parks, you know, biking to work, walkability, are things that are driving a lot of economic development in areas. So I think that's something in terms of a misconception is maybe from the business community looking at a traditional built environment model as opposed to how the shift is around walkability and and making it much more livable.
Right. And what are some of the other challenges, too, at getting those types of initiatives underway in these communities?
I think Columbia, for example, has done a great job in terms of the walkability, the bike lanes, and there's been a lot of change over the years here. So it's really important to see that. And I've been here since 1987, and people coming to this community say, well, this is really fantastic, being able to have those kind of amenities, and it's a great thing. Another thing is going from an individual level to a population level, it's not just around sugary drinks at the individual level, but who it's being marketed to. And that's where mapping also helps out, is being able to look at predominant race and ethnicity and looking at clusters of where there's predominant Hispanic, African-American, white, et cetera, and then looking at free and reduced lunch programs and what percent of the student body is eligible for free and reduced, and where free and reduced lunch programs, and where do those schools lie? Are they in areas of greater poverty, access issues? So again, it's taking it from an individual level around who's marketing to what segment of populations and what race, ethnicities, and that's a big challenge. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we're talking about kind of opportunities for an active lifestyle, right? But I'm sure you get plenty of other excuses for why people don't exercise. I don't know, Dr. Tosh, what examples?
Yeah, well, time, of course, is the big one. And, you know, no one has time, but you know, we really try to emphasize that this should be a priority, and you should, you know, the things that you prioritize is what you put your time into. So, you know, things like walking to school or biking to school would be a great example. I mean, you have to go to school. My patients have to go to school, so if it's possible to walk or bike, that would be what we would emphasize. But that gets into kind of what Dr. Fulcher kind of works on as well, is you have to have that infrastructure to make it safe, for example, for children to walk to school.
And I think that's really a big part of what we do around, for example, safe routes to schools. And we may not realize it, but Columbia has been looked at as a model around the country in terms of, again, safe routes to schools and how we're really heavy, the school bus program that was on for a number of years there. So it's really great to see how we can take these innovative ways in helping kids get more active.
Sure. Some of the things that we've done in the food environment is farm to school, using locally grown foods in school cafeterias. They normally have a better taste than does something that's been shipped for quite some time. Other things that the schools have done is they have policies about what can be offered for birthday parties and those kinds of things to help improve the food choices there as well. And also businesses have done that. You know, they've instituted policies about when, if you're going to have food, then it has to be healthy choices, and, you know, made it so that people get up and move as opposed to sitting at their desk the entire time. One of the things that CDC showed is, you know, places that have sprawl, a lot of sprawl, will have higher commute times and their obesity rates are higher in those cities, simply because people are in the car so much more than others.
Dr. Tosh, you talked about this before the break. When you have a parent that is obese or overweight and a child that's having these same issues, how do you have that conversation with the parent to try to, even if the parent maybe is not going to change their lifestyle, to talk about what should happen with their child?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I think, you know, most of the time when I see patients, it's the parent who brings them to see me. So I think usually there is some level of concern. Sometimes the thought is that the parent thinks it's maybe too late for them, but they do want the best for their child. Mm-hmm. So I do think the parents come from a sense of, what can I do to help? What can you help me with my child's weight concern? So, you know, I do think in general we try to partner with the parents. In general, I would say that parents are concerned about their child, and I would say the biggest disease that they know about is diabetes, and I would say that's the worst outcome of an overweight or obese child, is that they eventually develop diabetes. Because once you get diabetes, you have this cascade of other medical problems that you get. So if you can try to prevent diabetes, you're preventing a lot of other problems down the road. And in general, in many of these families, they know of someone in the family who has diabetes, and they know that's not a good lifestyle. They definitely don't want that for their child. So we come with that, and from that standpoint, and we can, on physical exam and on some blood work, we can sometimes see if a child has a risk for diabetes. And oftentimes, if we get some concerns, the parents realize, oh, this is more than just weight, that my child's at risk for diabetes, and that seems to motivate parents to really work hard on some of these issues. So again, in general, yes, sometimes the parents, there's some denial involved, but much more often, though, even if the parent's overweight, they still are very concerned about the health of their child and want to work with that child.
The CDC, in one of their many reports on obesity, pointed to the fee-for-service model as something that may actually be contributing to this, that there's not as much comprehensive coordinated care that happens for a patient. So, you know, until it turns into diabetes or something like that, there's not many opportunities or opportunities aren't taken to implement changes earlier on in the process. Do you see that as an issue in treatment, that kind of thing?
Up until recently, things have changed for the better, but up until recently, it was hard to get an insurance company to pay for a dietitian unless the diagnosis of diabetes was already made. And that's, you know, way too late, obviously. If we really want to focus on prevention, let's get that dietitian involved earlier on. Now, I would say things have moved in the right direction from that standpoint, but that was the case, as you described, for a very long time. It's hard to find a multidisciplinary program like we have, where you have a dietitian, a physician, maybe a therapist as well. Usually they're in the bigger cities, and so we get a lot of referrals from outlying areas, rural areas like you described earlier, but wouldn't it be nicer if those were available closer to our patients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the other, again, rural issues that are brought up here in Missouri especially? I don't know, Donna, things you've seen.
Well, it really has to do with food deserts and the fact that it's very difficult for children to be physically active in the rural areas.
What do people do? You mentioned food deserts. What do people do when there's not a grocery store nearby? Where do they get their food?
Convenience stores, where they get their gasoline. They may make one or two trips, a month or once a week. And then, the fruits and vegetables that they can obtain are not necessarily the highest quality in some of them because they're not necessarily being purchased. Of course, you can talk with them about, having frozen fruits and vegetables or canned fruits and vegetables, which are a good healthy alternative too. It'd be nice if there's a little less sodium or salt in the canned vegetables. It's very interesting. I grew up in a rural area on the west side of the state, and I was over there for an extended period of time taking care of my mother. And when you go to Walmart, I always tend to think of Walmarts as being the same everywhere. They're not. They have the foods that they had in their frozen food section or in their were for that population area. I said I could never move back here because I wouldn't be able to eat anything because their variety is not what I'm used to, and the types of foods that I like are not there or that I think are the healthier choices. So part of it is the fact that they don't have a grocery store, and then part of it is what does that store stock?
Is there any way, how do you make change there? I guess just it's what people buy, I guess, is part of what drives that, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's where we need additional education, and we need the schools and child cares and parks and businesses offering healthier choices so people are asking for those at the place where they buy their foods.
Sure. I'd take a moment to remind our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're talking about the state of obesity in Missouri. Over the last three decades, obesity rates in the state and across the country have more than doubled, growing steadily. Today, our guests are helping us figure out how we got here, which we hope will inform our way forward. We're joined by Dr. Anish Tosh with the Adolescent Obesity Clinic on clinical and research projects with the University of Missouri Health System. Chris Fulcher is the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental Systems, or CARES. And Donna Murley is a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. She coordinates the work of the Missouri Council for Activity and Nutrition. This is a special edition of Intersection from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the University of Missouri campus. This live forum was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls this week, but later in the show, our live audience will join in on today's conversation. Today's show is produced in partnership with the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk. So, yeah, Donna, you mentioned a little bit about, what's offered, but also what about food manufacturing? Does that play a role in a lot of what we're talking about here?
Yes. Actually, we have a couple of projects. One is Eat Smart in Parks, where we're working with the concessionaires at local parks or state parks, city parks, to provide healthier choices. And they're very interested in that because they're all into physical activity, and so that's the other half of being healthy. But some of the foods that, would be good for them to have available, they're not available to them through a distributor. You may be able to buy it in the grocery store as an individual, but they cannot necessarily buy that from one of their sources. Another thing that we've done in Extension is we've had some healthy corner store projects where, like in some of the inner cities or even in the rural areas, that you go to a store, a convenience store, whatever, and work with them to change the food offerings that are being provided to that population. There again, you have to build the demand as well, but oftentimes people will be more interested in going to that location and purchasing foods because they know it's available. Before when we were working on the Eat Smart in Parks pre-intervention phase, you know, we talked to people who brought their children to baseball games or went to the pool and asked them about what their impressions were of the concession stands. Well, they didn't go to them because they thought the food there was not healthy. So one of the other things that has to be done is when you change those, you have to let, someone was talking about marketing, you have to market the fact that there are additional healthy choices there so that people will go and purchase them.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get the buy-in of these communities? You know, I mean, what are some of the other challenges, I guess, in trying to make these kinds of changes in places that just don't have a, you know, organized sense around this?
You really have to have an organized sense. You need to go in and work with the community to see what it is that they want to have change in their environment. A lot of the local communities don't realize that they have an issue, and they don't realize that they can do anything about it. And so we have to help educate them that we can. And Chris probably has something to say.
I think what's really important as we look at obesity, again, I always come from a mapping population health level. So, you know, I'm a hammer and everything's a nail and it's a map. But really, everything that we do takes place somewhere. We're dealing with access issues. We're dealing with populations that are vulnerable. We're dealing with poverty. We're dealing with people in place. And so with communities, oftentimes, we don't have sufficient secondary data that's state level or national level to really help tell the story around what's happening in community. And so communities may not understand if there is an issue, like you just said. But with mapping, what it does is it brings people around the table where they can actually put points on a map, and they can start having conversations around the issues in their community. The definition of food desert, is this boundary, does it make sense to you in your community, or do we need to modify it based on our tacit knowledge, our understanding of our community? So it's really a galvanizing approach to bringing people together to better understand and coordinate around this obesity epidemic. And a lot of education, we talk about individual level, a lot of education also takes place at that policy environmental change level, working with organizations, school districts, state agencies, et cetera, and really looking at policies around alleviating childhood obesity. So it's the overlaps of policies. Where are they effective? Where have they been implemented? Are they making a difference? And then being able to look at this underlying data. So I guess in terms of the hammer and the nail analogy, we're focused on data-driven decision-making at more of a population level. And I wonder at an individual level, we look at manipulation-driven choice-making. And because how much are we actually being educated as opposed to marketed to? So it's a real tension at the individual level as opposed to the broader population level.
Well, yeah, and Donna, that's a big thing in Missouri, right? I mean, where do you draw the line between, you know, creating new laws? You know, like in some states you have, you know, taxes on soda and things like that, but also letting people, but you balance that between allowing people to have freedom of choice and things like that. How's that battle fight out?
A lot of it depends on what your population is willing to support. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that Chris is talking about is it's that overlay. You really need all your partners working together so that, one, you're having education, two, somebody's looking at the systems, somebody else is looking at policies within like childcare and schools and businesses. And we do have, in Missouri, we like local control, and we also have, but we also have some standards that are voluntary that childcare groups can take on as well as schools. Now, of course, some with the schools and childcare are required, but then they can go above and beyond what's required. And you work with them and provide technical assistance and help them to see the importance of what they're doing to change the lives of Missourians. We in our SNAP Ed program, we have stories where, you know, children have tried something at school in a SNAP Ed session or at a child care center, and they go to the grocery store and they want to buy the broccoli or the carrots or, you know, something that the parents would be concerned about purchasing because they were afraid the child won't eat them. So sometimes just helping children to taste those foods and learn to like them in another setting helps out with what's going on in the home environment as well.
Just wanted to mention, we're going to start opening up to questions here in a moment. So if you have a question, go ahead and raise your hand and people in the audience will come find you. I'll have us chat. One other quick question. We haven't talked a whole lot about the other health risks associated with obesity, right? Once you are obese, there are lots of other risks that may be involved. Dr. Tosh, maybe you can help us on some of those.
Oh, absolutely. So again, I mainly work with children and adolescents, but we are now seeing, in addition to diabetes, which used to be considered an old person disease, if I can use that term, but now we're seeing high blood pressure, high cholesterol. We're seeing sleep apnea, which again tends to be something we used to see in older patients. Now we're seeing in children and adolescents. It's all related to weight gain and obesity, which is, you know, really unfortunate. So we have these very young children having problems that they should not be having for another 40 years, and they're having it now in their teens. Those are the big ones we see. Those are the medical things. I already alluded to a little bit before the behavioral health issues as well. Almost 100% of my patients are teased or bullied at school because of their weight. Being overweight is the number one reason, identifiable reason, why a child's bullied at school. So that's another huge problem that we deal with as well, is the emotional behavioral aspect of obesity. The medical is serious enough, but sometimes if a child's being bullied or teased, now they can't learn because they're afraid to go to school. So those are some issues that we deal with as well in our clinic.
Okay. I think we had a question up here in the front. We'll go ahead and open up to some questions from our live audience today. We'll start here.
Well, actually, I have a question for each one of the panelists. Do you want me to give all three of them or one at a time?
Let's have you do one. We'll go to the next guy, and then we'll
okay.
see. Start with
well,
one.
Well, then I'll start with Ms. Murley. Is that right?
Good for you,
Thank
yes.
you. I work at Fulton State Hospital. And one thing that they have done is they have raised the price of unhealthy food and lowered the price of healthy food at the canteen. Are there schools and businesses that have begun doing something similar?
There may be. That is one of the ways of changing behavior, is because we like the value for our money. Sometimes it's really hard to get companies to consider that, or like vending machine owners to consider that, because they want a certain profit margin on each item. And so when you do that selective pricing, you're taking a chance that people will buy the lower cost items, which is what you want, but then your profit margin is not as high as what you would like. I think people who, groups that have done vending changes have seen an increase in the use of their vending machines over time. But yes, that has been done, and it's a good strategy. It works.
Yeah, this question.
This for any of the panel members. I was just curious, you started the program with the statistics between 1980 and today on obesity. And I was just curious, thinking about the data, are there any changes in the measurement or the definition of those things between then and now that creates any kind of issue comparing the statistics from those dates?
Well, in terms of the obesity statistics, no, those definitions have been around for quite some time. In fact, they're medically determined based on when the risks start showing up in terms of weight status. Now, there have been some changes in how the physical activity and fruits and vegetable intake have been measured, and so therefore you can't draw very many conclusions from that. But the weight status, no, that has not changed.
The question here. Go ahead.
Well, for all of my life, I heard you guys talking about sugary drinks earlier, and it seems like corn syrup has been used as a sugar substitute in most sugary drinks for all of my life. And PepsiCo, at least, and I know that there are a few Dr. Pepper distributors who have changed to sugar as of late. And they use it as a marketing ploy, but is there any sort of health benefit to consuming sugar as opposed to corn syrup, or corn syrup as opposed to sugar?
Yeah, probably not. You know, calories are calories. And again, as I mentioned, sugar in any form, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or just plain old cane sugar, you know, it tastes great. And kid, if you give a child an option between soda, regardless of how it's sugared, and water, unfortunately, most of my teenage patients will go for the soda. And so the key thing is how do we divert them more towards healthier options? So I know there's a lot of research and there's a lot of controversy in terms of high fructose corn syrup, for example. Maybe there is a slight, maybe it's slightly worse than sugar, but neither of them, I would say, is what I would endorse. And we really go for no sugared beverages a day, which is a really hard goal for a lot of our patients. But I've had patients who've been successful. They just made a family commitment. Okay, this is going to be a once-a-week thing for a sporting event or a birthday party, not what we drink every day at a meal. The families who've been successful with those changes are the ones losing weight.
Just a reminder for our listening audience, this is a live forum on the state of obesity in Missouri, and we're taking questions from our panel, our audience here for our panel. We have another question here in the back of the room.
I had a question for Dr. Tosh about the Healthy Kids Act. Lately in the last round of elections, a lot of control in the federal government went to the Republican Party, and obviously the Healthy Kids Act originated from the Democratic Party. Do you see any changes coming to the Healthy Kids Act because of the switching control, and how have you seen the Healthy Kids Act affect change in schools?
Yeah, and this may be something where Donna may be more familiar with it than I am from a policy standpoint, but I think it's nice to have federal standards. I think that's nice, but I think the problem's really being solved this locally anyway. So regardless what happens at the federal level, I think each community has a responsibility for its own young people and its population. So regardless of what happens at the federal level, I mean, I think there's changes that we've already discussed in terms of built environments, in terms of what we feed our children at school, that we can change regardless of the national political climate. And again, I think you may have more information. You're probably more knowledgeable than I am about
the federal policies. It remains to be seen what will happen, I believe. A lot of the policies are the right thing to do. Our children need to be more active. Our children need to be eating more healthily. And so one way or the other, those efforts will continue. It's very critical for our nation and for our defense for our children to be healthier. We have children, Dr. Tosh has talked about, you know, children starting with diabetes and heart disease. Well, those children are not going to be ready for the military. Those children may not even be ready for work. When you look at nursing home statistics, you will see that nursing home residents, there's a larger percentage of younger people in the nursing home. They don't even get to work. What happens is they end up in a nursing home right, you know, like when they're 20 or whatever, because they're so heavy that they cannot work. And so they're on Medicaid and they're there. And it's really changing the environments within the nursing homes as well. But the biggest concern is the impact on our nation as a whole with these changes.
Good. Some questions here in the front of the room.
Hi. This is a question for anyone. I think that the best leadership sets the example. So it's one thing for us all to realize that we have a problem in our state. It's another thing for us to say, well, what are we doing to be the example? As leaders in the community and as speakers on this subject, what are you doing personally to be an example to others in the community?
That's a good question. I think, you know, we live so much now in a time of distraction, and we live in a time where we don't have time to do the things we need to be doing and thinking, being more mindful and thinking through from a leadership perspective what we need to be doing. We've got a lot of data, we've got a lot of great technologies, but in some ways we almost abdicate to, well, here's a solution, here is a product, rather than the hard work of leadership that needs to affect change. And again, I used that example earlier, the phrase earlier of data-driven decision-making. I really cringe at that word. It's really people-driven decision-making informed by data or other appropriate information to help make those decisions. And I think there's a real need for leadership to go beyond just all the what we're learning from research and how we act on it. So it's a translational issue as well. There's a lot of great research going on. There's a lot of folks doing good work in different areas, but how do we translate that to help leaders make more effective decisions?
And some of the things that I do personally is I eat very healthily. I always have fruits and vegetables. I use appropriate, you know, preparation methods. I have done a half marathon once a year for the last several years, and try and encourage my friends to do that as well. It nearly killed us last year, but we're doing it again this year. the other thing that I do is I am a member of a local coalition in Jefferson City, Cole County, and we are working on reducing childhood obesity in that city. And I help with cooking in the kitchen, kids teaching kids how to cook. We have classes for some of the disadvantaged children. They're in foster care. And so those are some of the things that I do personally.
And if Dr. Tosh wants to answer the question, we'll have to do it off the air because we're actually, unfortunately, out of time. Thanks to our listening audience. This is a special edition of Intersection from the Fred Smith Forum at the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri campus. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Anish Tosh with the Adolescent Obesity Clinic on Clinical and Research Projects with the University of Missouri Health System. Chris Fulcher, the co-director of the Center for Applied Research and Environmental Systems, or CARES. And Donna Murley, a nutrition and exercise physiology associate at the University of Missouri Extension. Thanks to all of you here in our live audience who joined us for the forum today. Thanks for your great questions here. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast, the Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Today's show was produced in partnership with the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk. It was produced by Katie Heiler. Travis McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Maureen Lewis Stump, Hope Kerwin, Loel Thomas, and Maya Jackson. Austin Federa and Pat Akers are our audio producers. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Have a great week.